Here is Roger Beckwith and his article, The Canon of the Old Testament, in the book The Origin of the Bible, pages 55 and 56. Quote, "The references to the Pentateuch in whole or part as canonical, which we saw in the other books of the Old Testament and which continue in the intertestamental literature, are remarkably numerous. This is doubtless due in part to its fundamental importance. References to other books as inspired or canonical are, within the Old Testament, largely confined to their authors. The chief exceptions are probably Isaiah 34:16, Psalms 149:9, and Daniel 9:2. Another reason for this frequency of reference to the Pentateuch may, however, be that it was the first section of the Old Testament to be written and recognized as canonical. The likelihood that this was so arises from the fact that it was basically the work of a single prophet of very early date," of course he's referring to Moses, "which was edited after his death but was not open to continual edition, whereas other sections of the Old Testament were produced by authors of later date, whose number was not complete until after the return from the Babylonian exile. No one doubts that the Pentateuch was both complete and canonical by the time of Ezra and Nehemiah in the 5th century BC, and it may have been so considerably earlier." End quote. Now, I think this fact says a number of important things. First, it encourages us to regard the Pentateuch as being very early recognized as the divine word mediated through Moses. In fact, R.K. Harrison, in his Introduction to the Old Testament, page 264, believed that, quote, "There seem to be substantial grounds for thinking that it was virtually complete by the death of Samuel," that is circa 1012 BC. Beckwith points out that, quote, "The book of Deuteronomy was considered canonical even within Moses' lifetime," referring to Deuteronomy 31:24-26, "for this writing was placed inside the ark." The Origin of the Bible, page 54. Second, this shows that the selection of any other book was not an arbitrary exercise, since that book had to show itself to be in line with the five books of Moses. Nevertheless, many Jews from the intertestamental period onwards erred in that they held the Pentateuch, that is the Torah, to be more inspired than other Old Testament books. But the Bible itself offers no such support to the view. Although the Torah predates the other books, excepting the book of Job, there is good reason to think that the writings of the prophets, as well as the other books, were regarded as inspired when they were produced. And this case is made by E.J. Young in his article on the canon of the Old Testament in the book Revelation and the Bible, edited by Carl Henry, page 156. Christianity, through the examples of Jesus and the apostles, treated all the Hebrew scriptures as equally inspired. Some have thought that the third division, the writings, sometimes called the hagiographa, pose a more difficult problem when it comes to canonization. And I think this is true. For example, if you read Craig Evans's article on the scriptures of Jesus and his earliest followers, it's chapter 11 in the canon debate, you will see that he does not think that the canon was settled by the time of Jesus. It's actually a very disappointing article because Evans is an evangelical, although he hobnobs an awful lot with liberals, and it seems as though he's been rubbing shoulders much too closely with them, because Evans, who is, by the way, a New Testament scholar, not an Old Testament scholar, admits far too much doubt about the third division of the Hebrew Bible than is warranted by the evidence. Now, it's true that he does deal with much of the evidence that's been brought forward, but he deals with it in a very skeptical way, and he doesn't really tie that in with the way that the scriptures themselves speak and with the historical background of ancient Israel. Now, it is said by these critical scholars that because the writings are later than the prophets, and moreover, because the books within the third division are varied, that this creates a difficulty in their being identified as inspired and canonical in the way that the former divisions were. To this, Roger Beckwith replies, quote, "Even though the books of the hagiographa, that is, the writings, do tend to be later than the prophets, it is only a tendency, and the overlap is considerable." And he continues, "Since the books in both these sections, that is, the prophets and the writings, are by a variety of authors and are usually independent of one another, it may well be that they were recognized as canonical individually at different dates and at first formed a single miscellaneous collection." End quote. Origin of the Bible, page 58. He notes that since the prologue to the apocryphal book Ecclesiasticus, which was written towards the close of the 2nd century BC, mentions a three-stage canon, the full threefold canon must have been recognized prior to that time. He suggests that, quote, "the date when the prophets and hagiographer were organized in their separate sections was probably about 165 BC. Now, Evans, in his essay, tries to dismiss this view of the hagiographer being settled by about 165 BC by placing an awful lot of emphasis on Eugene Ulrich's view that the ancient Hebrews incorporated the Psalms as part of the prophets. On page 188, Evans writes, "David, in 4QMMT, that is, one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, probably refers only to the Psalms, which at Qumran may have been understood as somewhat related to the prophets. This possible connection between the prophets and the Psalms may be relevant to the canon of Jesus, which will be considered below." Now notice all of these qualifications by Evans. David probably refers to the Psalms, basing his research on Ulrich. May have been understood as somewhat related to the prophets. This possible connection may be relevant. And you'll find in what Evans writes that he actually makes it decisive for his interpretation of the writings and his conclusion that the writings were clearly not recognized in the time of Jesus. Whereas other experts like Lehman and Beckwith thoroughly disagree. And they say that the Psalms, or David, was the name that was given to the collection of writings that became known as the Hagiographa. Hagiographa, of course, means sacred writings in Greek. And it does appear that these writings did not have a settled order until about the 1st century AD. But as far as their content was concerned, that is a different thing. But without going into this any more, we say that despite the imaginative recreations of the liberals, it is a well-founded opinion that says that the Hebrew canon as a whole was recognized as such long before the New Testament era. And following Beckwith, Paul House believes that, quote, "the entire Old Testament canon was set in 164 BC. Now, it is true that one does not get a specific listing of the books of the hagiographer, sometimes known as the writings, sometimes known as Psalms, following its biggest book, with the ancient Hebrews. But that is because it seems that they hadn't decided on a generally agreed upon name. But this certainly doesn't mean that the canon was not settled. Now, before we go on to the New Testament evidence, we need to say something about the Septuagint. The LXX, or Septuagint, must enter into any discussion of the Hebrew canon. The work itself is often not well represented by non-specialists, so it might help if we provide a brief survey of exactly what we're talking about. The first item which we must consider is the meaning of the term Septuagint. As a matter of fact, this term is a Christian one, from the Latin Septuaginta, meaning 70, and it was first used in about the middle of the 2nd century AD, according to Karen Jobes and Moises Silva in their book Invitation to the Septuagint, page 36. Our main source for the history of the Septuagint is the so-called Letter of Aristeas, an Alexandrian work from about the 2nd century BC, in which the author, Aristeas, is supposedly writing to an acquaintance, perhaps his brother, with information about how the Egyptian king Ptolemy Philadelphus made request of the high priest at Jerusalem, a man called Eleazar, to send to Alexandria the Hebrew scrolls from the temple, as well as a group of translators who could render them into Greek. Now, Ptolemy Philadelphus died in 247 BC, and he was the guy who was responsible for the great library at Alexandria. Now, it ought to be stressed at this point that only the Torah is said to be translated, not the whole Old Testament, something that F.F. Bruce also notices on page 44 of your textbook. This means that, strictly speaking, the term Septuagint should be reserved for the Greek translation of the first five books of Moses alone. But, of course, it's been expanded to include the whole of the Old Testament, although you'll find that the more technical works on it, for example, Timothy McLeay's book, The Use of the Septuagint in the New Testament, will call it the Old Greek rather than the Septuagint. Now, there is much that is dubious, not to say fabulous, in Aristeas's relation of the story. To give just a couple of examples, Aristeas is said to petition the king for release of 4,000 Jewish prisoners as a goodwill gesture to Eleazar. Ptolemy not only complies, but sends extravagant gifts to Jerusalem. He also says that 72 Jewish scribes, six from each tribe, arrive at the king's court, and during a seven-day feast in which they are asked all kinds of difficult questions, proving themselves superior, by the way, to the pagan philosophers in court, they then sit down to translate the sacred scrolls, a labor that is finished in 72 days. Well, whatever one makes of this document, most scholars believe that a translation of the Torah into Greek was done at this time, and therefore the letter of Aristeas does preserve some historical truth. The remaining books of the Old Testament were probably translated into Greek sometime between the 2nd and 1st centuries BC, although perhaps not at Alexandria. Certainly, it appears very likely that a number of Greek translations, rather than one authorized translation, were in widespread use among the Hellenistic Jews of the diaspora by the time of Christ. This circumstance itself brings up a problem as concerns the Old Testament canon, for the Septuagint includes apocryphal writings alongside canonical ones in the Old Testament. In light of this, must we follow the lead of critical scholarship and reevaluate the canon? The question which must be asked is whether or not the Septuagint, and those who used it, regarded the books of the Apocrypha as being of the same status with our canonical books. As we shall see when we look at the Apocrypha, those works are generally so inferior to the accepted canon that a negative answer almost forces itself upon us. It should also be remembered that, as R.K. Harrison says, all the extant manuscripts of the LXX are of Christian, not Jewish, origin, and the earliest manuscripts of it are contained in the Roman Catholic codices Vaticanus, Sinaiticus, and Alexandrinus from the 4th and 5th centuries AD, and these contain extra canonical books, although not exactly the same ones, in both the Old and New Testaments. and so they are questionable sources upon which to depend for information on the shape of the Hebrew canon. It is true that Christians have derived their list of Old Testament books in part after the example of the LXX or Septuagint, but they have not followed the LXX exactly, and so this is not a basis for an expansion of the canon or a questioning of the canon. Now, better data is available in the form of plain citations from the works of ancient Hebrew authors. Philo of Alexandria, for example, who died circa 45 AD, never cited apocryphal books as scripture, nor, according to Paul House, does Sirach, Maccabees, or any of the later rabbis. And when one recalls that Jesus' mention of the law, the prophets, and the Psalms in Luke 24:44 was a common designation for the books of the Hebrew Scriptures as we know them, we can be confident that the Apocrypha, though sometimes cherished by Israel, was not accorded the same kind of reverence as the canonical scriptures. Finally, a major criterion for determining the canonical worthiness of any book was whether it was composed between a certain time span. Thus, we can say that even though the Alexandrian Jews likely included, and indeed wrote, many of these non-inspired apocryphal works in their Greek translations, they were never deemed to be canonical. That is, they did not, to use the Jewish term, render the hands unclean, a phrase that possibly signified that contact with such scrolls demanded ritual hand washing after handling in order that conditions of ceremonial purity might be maintained. R.K. Harrison, Introduction to the Old Testament, page 261. Thus, as R.K. Harrison notes in his article in the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, quote, "The manuscripts discovered at Qumran make it evident that no canonical book of the Old Testament was written later than the Persian period, a consideration that also extends to Daniel and those Psalms which were formerly regarded as Maccabean. Whatever stage the work of translation had reached in Alexandria, the Hebrew canon in Palestine was already complete in all its essentials by that period." End quote. Now, someone who knows a little bit about the Dead Sea Scrolls might well say, well, yes, we have Hebrew copies of all of the books at Qumran, but we don't have the Book of Esther. So does that mean that the Book of Esther was not considered canonical at that time? In response to that, Beckwith notes that the Essenes had a calendar which they held to be divine, but that calendar conflicts with Esther. And so, of course, they had an inbuilt prejudice against Esther. It is also a fact that Esther was treasured by the Maccabees, and the Qumran community despised the Maccabees. So again, there's another reason for leaving out Esther. F.F. Bruce has a footnote on this on page 39 of the Canon of Scripture. Well, what about the Dead Sea Scrolls then? Well, we're not going to go into a great deal here about them. All we need to say at this juncture is that it appears that the group who lived there, who were possibly a group of Jews known as the Essenes, although that is being more and more doubted in contemporary literature, were taken with some of the apocryphal books, including one or two of their own, as they supported some of their more idiosyncratic dogmas. And so they should not be held as being exemplars for the way that the rest of the Jews in Palestine, and particularly in Jerusalem, were behaving towards their sacred scriptures. This is a mistake that liberals often make, and it's made by some of the contributors to the canon debate. But this group, whoever they were not part of mainstream Jewish culture, and it is not wise to read much into their opinions regarding the Hebrew canon. Certainly, there is much in the discoveries of the Dead Sea Scrolls which are extremely important, because for the most part they prove that there was a tremendous correspondence between the Masoretic Jewish text of circa 500 AD and after and the Hebrew text as it was known at Qumran. And it should also be mentioned that there were other manuscript finds in the Judean desert at Masada, for example, which dated from the 1st and early 2nd century AD, which show very favorable comparisons with the Masoretic text. As Emanuel Tov writes on page 235 of the Canon Debate, detailed comparisons of the medieval manuscripts with texts from Murab Ba'at, Nahal, Heva, Sadir, Se'alim, and Masada show that the medieval texts, though adding layers of vowels, accents, and Masoretic notes, preserve the ancient proto-rabbinic texts very well. They are actually identical, since the ancient scrolls do not differ more from the medieval manuscripts than the latter differ among themselves. End quote. Thus, although people like Tov, who are textual critics, like to point up some of the variants and differences in spelling and punctuation and so on between the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Masoretic text, for the purposes of canon, it shows that there was an agreed-upon text, even back as far as before the time of Christ. Well, what about criteria of canonicity? Can we say anything about that? Well, we should state at the outset, as we did earlier on, that very little is known about how exactly the Jews formed their sacred books. But one or two criteria do seem to have been important. First and foremost was the recognition of prophetic authorship. In those cases where this appears an unsuitable guide, it must be remembered that the book of Job was attributed to Moses, that Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Canticles were attributed to Solomon, and that Esther was attributed to Mordecai, who was revered as a prophet by the ancient Jews. Information on that is in Harrison's Introduction to the Old Testament, page 268. A second important criteria was a chronological one, testified to by Josephus, who wrote at the end of the 1st century AD. In his Apology Contra Appion, written circa 100 AD, Josephus states that the Hebrew scriptures were written between the time of Moses and the time of Artaxerxes, that is, the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. This would automatically exclude any apocryphal books. And then thirdly, it must never be forgotten that these works were inspired by the Spirit of God. He, then, is the one who is responsible for the actual formation of the canon. As Old Testament scholar E.J. Young reminds us, quote, "In the very nature of the case, because God is the creator and man the creature, man can only identify the Word of God if God himself enables man so to identify it." That's from Revelation and the Bible, page 157. In summary, then, the Old Testament scriptures are a collection of God-breathed books, preserved by the providence of God and identified as such by devout Jews from the time of their first appearance. Although one must allow for some occasional slight editorial activity, especially in the historical books, it is a good bet to date the final canonization of all the Old Testament at around 165 BC.